Today is Tuesday. It's May 26th, 2020. And this is part 5 of a Grand Canyon oral history interview with Esther Litton, spelled E-S-T-H-E-R-L-I-T-T-O-N. My name is Tom Martin. Good afternoon, Esther. How are you today?
I'm very well, thank you.
Good. Good to hear it. May we have your permission to record this conversation?
Yes, you do.
Thank you. One of the things I had been meaning to ask you as we go through the 1960s and 50s is about the names of your children and how you and Martin came up with those names. Could you recount that for us?
John, I think, was named for Martin's grandfather. He was named John Clyde, and Clyde was Martin's father's first name. And then Kathleen, we had a neighbor when we lived in Brentwood, whose name was Kathleen, and she was a very lovely neighbor. We were very good friends, and I did love the name, so I named Kathleen after her. And Donald was named for Martin's younger brother, whose name was Donald, and I don't remember Donald's middle name. Donald, he will scold me for forgetting it.
Oh dear, no worries.
Donald was named for Martin's younger brother. And my fourth child, Helen, was named for somebody, a very good friend of Martin's mother.
Nice. Very nice. Thank you for covering that. When we left off last time, you had mentioned Martin worked closely with Wallace Stegner.
Yes, Wallace Stegner and Martin were on the board of the Sierra Club, and Wallace Stegner lived fairly close to our home. And so for the board meetings in the evenings when they occurred, Martin would pick up Wallace Stegner and take him to San Francisco for the meeting and return him to his home. I got to know Wallace Stegner and his wife Mary later fairly well, because in the later years I went on a trip to Tanzania where he and Mary were a part of the group that traveled to Tanzania. However, at the time Martin was on the Sierra Club, there was the argument about Diablo Canyon, and unfortunately Wallace Stegner took the opposite side that Martin took. Wallace Stegner sided with the people who said Diablo Canyon was acceptable, and Martin and some of the others debated they were against the selection of Diablo Canyon. So I think their friendship kind of frazzled at that point.
I see. It's interesting in reviewing the conservation record of these issues being so passionate that if people disagreed, they basically stopped their friendship.
Yes, in fact, Martin disagreed heartily with Ansel Adams, because Ansel Adams also took the side that Diablo Canyon was acceptable. And the Diablo Canyon arguments resulted in David Brower's leaving as executive director of the Sierra Club. I don't remember which year that was, but it did cause him to leave and form his own company. I don't remember the name of the company. Something about
was that Friends of the Earth?
Yes, Friends of the Earth. Yes.
Okay, thank you.
He formed his own company, but forgotten the date, but it was as a result of the arguments about Diablo Canyon.
Do you briefly, very briefly, remember the pro and con arguments of that issue? This is a nuclear power plant on the ocean, isn't it?
Yes, I could give you the details if you want the details.
Just briefly, yes, please.
Yes, the original location was to be in an area south of that called Nipomo Dunes, which part of it is part Sierra Club, was adamant about it not going into the Nipomo Dunes. So PG&E looked around and they found Avila, the town of Avila, and that harbor, and they proposed building it in Avila. But the owner of the property on Avila had a substantial beachfront property, which he wanted to develop into apartment houses. But he also had access to Diablo Canyon, so he talked PG&E into considering Diablo Canyon. At the time, PG&E had a geologist, whom we met later, who did the geological studies and did warn them that there were earthquake faults under the area of Diablo Canyon where they proposed to build the nuclear plant. Diablo Canyon was an untouched side canyon that went deeply into the mountains and had some magnificent coast live oaks, tremendous spread to their branches, and it was fern covered and had a little stream going down. And Martin had visited it a couple of times and taken pictures to show the Sierra Club board what would be lost if PG&E covered that canyon, as they surely would if they built the nuclear plant. So he had exhibited all these photographs of the area, which was very beautiful. But PG&E insisted on that area, and so the permission was given, in spite of the fact that they knew about the earthquake faults, which later on, many years later, I met with the geologist who said, in the years after Diablo Canyon, he studied the faults and found that there were many more that he had discovered at the time of the proposal for the nuclear plant. But at that time, there was just maybe one or two faults that PG&E thought that they could deal with. So they went ahead with the plant.
Is that plant still in operation today?
No, it isn't, because we have found that it is more dangerous. They have found more earthquake faults, and I believe it's being not torn down, but it's not working now.
Decommissioned?
Decommissioned, yes, that's the term. Yes.
Okay.
That's the term, yes. Actually, when the man who owned the property on Avila, where he was going to build his apartments, he did build his apartments, but he went broke with them.
Hmm. Interesting.
Anyway, this is what I remember about the history, because I made some trips to the area before it was covered up, and it was a beautiful canyon.
Hmm.
And we discovered a place in the rock by the kitchen midden, but it was a big rock that had a depression and a pestle. So it was a mortar and a pestle used by the Indians at the time they were living there.
Wow.
It was a very popular and well-documented living space for the Indians at the time.
Nice. So did that happen frequently or very rarely, where there would be a decision and it would split people apart one way or another in the conservation community?
Well, it was debated in the Sierra Club. I don't know about any other conservation community, but it was hotly debated. And as I say, Martin took a lot of aerial pictures of the place and pictures on the ground of the canyon itself to try to convince the board that they should not accept that position. So it divided the board. Most of the board went in favor of Diablo Canyon, and there were a few who did not like the choice of Diablo Canyon.
I guess I was thinking of Bestor Robinson and the rest of the board with the Sierra Club and just some other issues where people who were friends and friendly suddenly realized they were on different sides of an issue.
Well, I don't or against it. Ford was one of the members of the board from Santa Barbara, and I think his name was Eisler. So Martin had a few supporters of his objection to Diablo Canyon. But I don't remember. I know Ansel Adams and Wallace Stegner specifically were in favor of Diablo Canyon. They thought it was a good alternative to the Napomo Dunes.
Well, let's go back to Wallace before the Diablo Canyon issue. What else do you remember, just interesting things about him and his wife?
Well, the only time that I really got to know him was later in 1981 when we were on the Africa trip. But while Martin was on the board of the Sierra Club, I think I met him casually when we first moved up to the Bay Area, and Martin got involved in the Committee for Green Foothills, which Wallace Stegner started along with other citizens from Palo Alto. And the reason for the Committee for Green Foothills was that Stanford University, with its vast holding of thousands of acres, had decided to dedicate part of the acreage to possible business ventures, and they decided which businesses they would accept. One was IBM, one was Xerox, one was Hewlett Packard. They were specific companies that they agreed on, that they gave permission to start building on this commercial land, and the building started at the main drag, which was El Camino. But their property extended a couple miles up into the foothills, and suddenly Hewlett Packard had built fairly close to the foothills their business building. It was not the plant; it was a business building, administration building, and the hills were threatened as far as the local people who lived nearby by future. Manufacturing, future business buildings going up. And so they referred to the Green Foothills. They objected to Stanford's plans, which seemed to extend into the foothills. So they formed, Wallace Stegner and a few others formed the Committee for Green Foothills. One of their objections was that Hewlett Packard, when it opened, kept their lights on all night. Mm. But anyway, it was the threat of future development. But it pretty much stopped where Hewlett Packard and a few other business buildings came up, and it edged up to a street called Foothill Expressway. So some of the foothills were still left alone. But that was their concern with the Stanford's plans. And at the time we moved up to the Bay Area in 1954, Stanford had already developed quite a big acreage along the main street, El Camino, into a very large shopping center, which became a tourist attraction in future years because they had some shops like Cartier and other companies that really catered to the wealthy people. But when they opened the shopping center, it was just a grocery store, a 5 and 10 cent store, the Emporium, and a bank. And so it was limited to a few really useful stores that the general public could use, like the 5 and 10 and the hardware and the grocery store. But anyway, Stanford had started to expand their holdings, building on their holdings, and the people who lived in the foothills were really concerned with what Stanford was going to do with this foothill property. So that was the beginning of the Committee for Green Foothills.
Okay. And there's a lot of vineyards there today, aren't there?
A lot of what?
Vineyards?
Vineyards?
Yeah.
No, there are. There are some in the foothills.
Yeah, in the foothills. Property. Right.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, up on Tucson Skyline, Fogarty had a vineyard there. And then there were some neighborhood vineyards in their backyards. They'd have a little vineyard, but there was no great vineyard development there except for Fogarty's.
Okay, all right. Nice. So they got to work together on that project. And then Ansel Adams, what was Ansel was a photographer, is taking black and white images and using them for conservation purposes.
Yes, he was. Yes, and the Sierra Club did publish his book. I think it's This American Earth. I can't remember for sure what the title of the book was, but it was of Ansel Adams' black and white photographs.
And what do you remember about Ansel?
I remember that when Martin first went to work for Sunset and was attached to the Sierra Club, we were invited to Ansel Adams' home, which was then in San Francisco, in an area called Seacliff, which had been his family home when it was just sand dunes, and the family had settled there, and he still had the family home. And we were invited to a meeting. At the time, he was introducing Beaumont Newhall, and this was a couple who admired Ansel's work and considered his work artistic, and they wanted to have a photography designation in the arts or gallery in the East Coast. And Ansel Adams was introducing the Newhalls to a group of people, and we were invited to that. There were several artists there, and that was the evening that we went. And I remember among the artifacts that he had scattered around in the room was a chambered nautilus, which of course was cut in half, so you could see all the divisions of the chambered nautilus. And I thought it was very charming, the variety of things he had scattered around in the living room. And we did meet, I think we met some of the other people attached to the Sierra Club. But that was the only social thing I ever did with Ansel Adams.
Okay. There were some other river running people that I wanted to ask you about. Do you remember a river runner named John Vail?
John Vail had, I think, a few user days on the Grand Canyon, and he used the rubber drafts. He and George went came together at the time they proposed purchasing Martin's contract permit, and this was many years later, 1989, but I think Martin was aware of John Vail on the river. And I think he was aware of George Winch. They were simply on the river at the same times, and he met with them off and on. But they were not big friendships. But as I say, in 1989, they came forward with a proposal to buy Martin's permit in the Grand Canyon.
I see. Okay. I was mistaken there, and I thought he might have had a collegial friendly relationship with them back in the 1960s.
No.
Okay. Another river runner was Joe Monroe.
Oh, Joe Monroe. He was a photographer, a magazine photographer, and he had some rafts. Joe Monroe and Martin got together to do a short half-hour film, I think it was a half-hour film, called Daring the Wild River. And the idea of this film was that Joe, who had thought he had connections with the TV stations, would present the film to the TV people and have them buy it and show it on TV. It was a very sad split at that time with Martin and Joe, because Joe failed to sell it to the TV people.
Oh.
And the argument was that Joe hadn't thought ahead to decide on a price that he wanted, the cost that he wanted for the film. And so he kind of fumbled the ball, and Martin never forgave him. He didn't speak to him for years after that. It it was very embarrassing because in terms of social gatherings, Martin would absolutely not speak to him, and I wasn't supposed to speak to him either. However, this is kind of scattered, but I have to move ahead to the fact that Joe Monroe had two rafts tied together, and he was along on the Apollo Centennial, the portion of the river trip from Green River, Utah, through Labyrinth, Stillwater, and Cataract. And he had this was before they split up in anger, but he had these two rafts together, which he was experimenting with. And in going around Cataract, Martin was taking a film of his rafts, and Martin jammed his leg down into the talus and damaged it very, very much. He was in great pain until they got to Height, which was the takeout point for the Green River trip. And Martin went to the hospital in Page, where the doctor told him that he should stay off of his leg. And Martin said, well, he had to go on the Grand Canyon portion, which was coming up. And the doctor said, well, if you were in the boat, be sure you have your leg above your heart, because you're in a bad shape here with your leg. Anyway, that was what resulted in that particular.
Well, don't end the story there. Then what happened?
Well, Martin went on with the river trips, and they ended the Grand Canyon portion of the Powell Centennial. And toward the end, he had a black hat and a black coat, an empty sleeve. And at Overton, he played the part of Powell in a ceremony that was supposed to duplicate Powell's ceremony when he got to Overton. And they had a watermelon feast or something like that. So that was when the Powell Centennial ended, as far as we were concerned. Powell, of course, went on and got to the Delta, but the Powell Centennial celebration ended at Overton on Lake Mead.
Okay. And
we've gone way ahead out of order, but anyway, that was what happened.
No worries, because we'll go back. And what happened to Martin's leg? Did that heal up then?
No, it healed up, but he forever had cellulitis.
Oh.
He had very, very damaging cellulitis in that leg, which he also got in the other leg. So over his lifetime, I was constantly aware of when he would get a fever, and he would kind of be out of it, and I would get him to the hospital, and he would spend quite a bit of time over the years in the hospital from the flare-ups of the cellulitis.
So before Joe and Martin had a falling out, what do you remember about Joe? What was he like?
Oh, he was very, very, very nice, very friendly. And the thing is, we went to his home, I think it was in Orinda, when they had the footage together for the film, and we had a showing of the film at his home. And he had a lovely wife who was very artistic. It was a very friendly relationship. It was just that when he went to the TV people, and they had these high expectations of the fact that this film would be purchased, be shown on TV, and it all fell through. Martin got so mad.
Oh, that's too bad.
It is too bad, because we did come in contact with him off and on later. And it was never, well, Martin didn't speak to him.
Okay.
So,
Is there anything else in the 1960s before 1968? I mean, just there were so many different conservation issues going on. It sounds like you traveled a lot. Are there any other travels that you wanted to mention?
Well, yes. Mineral King came up toward the end of the 60s. Mineral King was a beautiful wilderness canyon. It had been a mine, which petered out. Mineral King was a small settlement. It was no longer being mined. It was a small segment of the boundary of Mineral King that did incorporate Sequoia National Park. Otherwise, the whole area was national forest. And sometime in the before the 60s, Disney had visited it, apparently, and thought it would make a wonderful ski resort. He admired it. He was going to do such a good job and keep it just as beautiful as it was. And the Forest Service said okay. They would give him a temporary okay. Well, in the late 60s, 1965, Kathleen researched this recently. Disney reminded the parks, the Forest Service, that they had been agreeable to his making, to his creating this park. Well, the Sheriff Martin and I had been there at that time in 19, our son John was just 2 years old. He was born in 46, so I think in 48, when I was pregnant with Kathleen. We had done a pack trip taking John into Mineral King, so we knew what Mineral King was like, and he argued with the Sierra Club that it should not be turned over to Disney. They should fight this okay of the Forest Service, and so Martin took pictures of it, had pictures of it, and over the years from 65 to 70, which is beyond the time that he was at Sunset, but he was still on the board, he had members of the Sierra Club come to Palatka City in a demonstration, a visit to Mineral King. As a result of this argument, actually, the Sierra Club did not have political clout. They couldn't sue as a conservation company, and it was turned out to be a very important case. Well, I'll tell you what happened. The Sierra Club formed Earth Justice, which through Earth Justice they could sue, but the suit was against the government to protect a natural place, which was Mineral King. And technically, you could not sue for a natural place, so a natural thing, instead of a company, corporation, or a person. At that time, there was no possibility. However, it went to the Supreme Court. And William O. Douglas, who was on the Supreme Court at the time, was an ardent conservationist. And he backed the idea of being able to sue for a place or an artifact or something, you know, that was not a person or a corporation. And it passed the Supreme Court. They could now sue. And Reagan, who was the governor at the time, was all gung-ho about Disney to do this. But the Supreme Court knocked it down and said no, they could not build the ski lift at all. They were out of the business. And what essentially happened was that the only hook that they had was a small section of the road, which is still a very narrow, winding road. And it would have required a tremendous amount of engineering to build a road that would serve a ski lift. But anyway, because of that little bit of the road, which was part of the Sequoia National Park, the whole thing became, the whole area became a part of the Sequoia National Park.
Nice.
And curiously enough, and years later, there was a group that came to see Martin from Japan. It was a Japanese conservation group that was trying to sue the government about something, some natural phenomenon in the delta, one of the rivers, something they wanted to save from destruction. they wanted to see Mineral King. So they contacted Martin, and Martin took them up to Mineral King. It was winter, so they weren't able to get down into the canyon itself very far, but they did see enough that they realized what had been saved. And they went back to Japan. I don't know whether they were able to save what they were trying to save, but they were interested enough and knew enough about the truth that they came to California to see what had been, what had happened.
Nice. Very nice. You also mentioned that in 1968, Martin left the job with Sunset.
Yes. In 1908, quite a few things happened. First of all, my mother was very ill, and I brought her up to the Bay Area to stay with me. And at the same time, I was offered a job by the librarian as a partial, part-time job. She had acquired from the San Mateo County a great amount of instructional materials. Each school district had an instructional materials center where they had extra materials for the teachers, in our case from kindergarten to eighth grade, covering the curriculum of the different grades. She had acquired quite a bit of this material, and she wanted somebody to come and catalog it and accession it. But it wasn't going to be a full-time job. It was going to be just a part-time job from 9 to 1, and it would involve additional activities like delivering the mail in the morning from the superintendent to the two schools, and then in the afternoon at 1 o'clock deliver the mail again to these different places. And in between, the clerk would gather these materials, collect them, catalog them, accession them, and then add to the collection for the school in items that I might find, like butterflies, lizards, volcanoes, anything that would add to the instructional materials for the school curriculum. So that was to be my job. It was from 9 to 1, and I thought it was just perfect, absolutely perfect. So I started in September. Soon after my mother passed away, which happened while she was with me. Well, in December, Martin had scheduled for the following year an article about the formation of the fact that it was now the Redwood National and State Parks. It finally was the National Park. And Mrs. Johnson, Lady Bird Johnson, had taken a very active part in supporting the National Park. She had come out several times, apparently, was in love with the Redwoods, and they dedicated it, they made it grow, the Lady Bird Grove. And in December, she came out to dedicate the Lady Bird Grove. At the same time, Martin had written a short article, I think, to announce the fact in a future issue that the National Park, the Redwood National and State Parks, was in existence and where the headquarters, anyway, an article about the park. Well, all of these years between 1960 and 1968, the lumber companies had watched what Martin was writing. And Martin in December went to a meeting in Eureka and took Bill and Jean Wayne up to this meeting, which was taking place in Eureka. It was going to be represented by some of the lumber companies. And while they were there, Bill Wayne sat next to the Weyerhaeuser representative, and Bill Wayne mentioned that they were going to have this article about the new national park in the Redwoods. And the Weyerhaeuser representative said he would like to see this article before it was printed. So the Lanes went on up to a meeting up in Washington State, and Martin came home. The custom was always to post what the future articles were going to be on a bulletin board, and the article had been posted on the bulletin board when Martin left for this meeting. But when he came back, the Lane had called and told them to take the article off the board because the Weyerhaeuser people wanted to see it before it was printed, and they could always print it at a later date. But when Martin saw that the article was off of the board, came home and he said, I quit. And when Bill Lane came back from that, he sent Martin's secretary out to our house several times saying he was sorry Martin was so offended, but they were going to print the article later and to please forget it. I didn't say a word because over the years that Martin had been at Sunset, he had had many issues with the editing of his articles. Every once in a while, somebody would move a comma or change a word or change a caption, and he would complain. And I really was sick and tired of his complaining. So when he decided he would quit, I didn't say a word. I think that the Lane family thought I would surely say something because we had four children. And, you know, what was Martin going to do? But I didn't know what he was going to do, but I knew I was ready to accept the fact that he was quitting. So he quit December 31st, and he had to keep on doing another story. He had a story on Death Valley scheduled, so he had to finish that. But 1969 was the Powell Centennial, and he had been asked by the Sierra 12 Board to represent Powell when they were going, and Martin had a couple of boats by that time, so they were going to reproduce Powell's journey from Green River, Wyoming, to the end, to Overton, as far as they could go during the year, and schedule portions of that trip, which they couldn't do all the way anymore because they were Flaming Gorge Dam and Glen Canyon Dam, but they could do portions of it.
Mm-hmm.
So that was what he did. It became Powell, and they started at Green River, Wyoming. All they were able to do at that point was to launch the three boats that they had representing Powell's three boats, launch it and go a few feet and get out, because there were dams along the way that impeded their trip. So they had that part scheduled, and then they had Gray and Desolation on the Green scheduled, which ended at Green River, Utah. Then there was Cataract, Labyrinth, and Stillwater for that part of the Green. And then they would hop over, because they got out at Height, and then they would hop over to the beginning of Lee's Ferry and do a couple of the Grand Canyon sections and end up in Overton at approximately the time that Powell had reached Overton. And so that was the Powell Centennial. And as a result of the Powell Centennial, the young people who worked for the Sierra Club had been involved in the planning and all of that. So they urged Martin to keep on. He had these two boats, and why didn't they schedule more trips? And at the end of 1969, I must say that I joined the trip at Green River, Utah for the Cataract, Stillwater, and Labyrinth section.
So tell me all about it. Yeah.
I had all of that ready. Martin had Donald with him, who was 10, and my older children were gone in college, and they were not involved in the centennial. So I was ready to start the car and go. But Donald's dog had gotten into the habit of running down the hill to the street, to the beer garden at the foot of the street. And the people who, the men, working men who would be there would feed the dogs. So, unfortunately, she had disappeared while I was busy loading the car. And when I went to look for her, I couldn't find her. And I drove around the neighborhood and calling her. I went out of the beer garden looking for her, and I couldn't find her. I didn't know what I was going to do because I didn't know where the dog was. Fortunately, Donald had a collar on the dog that had his name and telephone number. It was a creek that ran behind the beer garden, and somebody called to say that our dog was dead.
Oh, my.
And apparently had gone down to the creek to drink, but had died there. So there I was. I went to get the dog, and the workman there helped me put the poor dog into the car. And I had to run to the veterinarians to say, what could I do with the poor dead dog? And they took the dog off my hands. And I drove from there on. I picked up Marge Childress, who helped me get the food. And she was going to be on the trip. Her husband, Clyde Childress, they had a rowboat called the Mabel T, which was on the trip. And so she and I made our way across Nevada over to Utah, to Green River, Utah, and joined the river trip there. And it's a beautiful section of the river, like Laverne Stillwater Cataract. It goes through canyon lands. It's not a very violent river until you get to Cataract. And Cataract has some really big rapids.
So Esther? Where were the rest of the children?
They were in college.
Oh, okay.
And, I think John was already in Vietnam, involved in the Vietnam War.
Okay. Thank you.
Kathleen was not involved. She would Martin had never encouraged her. She had never shown any great interest in the river trips.
Okay.
So she, I think, was in college at the time. So, and Helen, you know, that's a good question. I don't remember what I did with Helen. I think that I found somebody to come and stay with her. But at the committee, I had found a place for Helen to stay for that week that I was going to be gone.
Okay, so from Green River, Utah, the river goes through Labyrinth and Stillwater, picks up the confluence with the Colorado, and then goes off into Cataract Canyon. And what do you remember of that river trip, that section?
I didn't hear that last, because at one point it joins the Colorado.
Yep. And what...
Green and Colorado come together when you're still on the Green. And then it becomes the Colorado. The Green pretty much ends there.
Yes. And so what do you remember of that river trip?
Well, it was delightful. It was Bill Hyde was along to photograph it. We had some interesting people along on the trip. One of them, Dennis and his wife, Dr. Torgan and Linda. Linda later was so enamored with the river trip that she came back several times, and later she divorced her husband and married one of the boatmen. But anyway, it was a lovely group, and Phil stopped many times to get pictures, and Donald had a great time. He was just 10. He was having a real good time. And Marge and I were very compatible with the food. We did the cooking and all that. And I remember Joe Monroe was singing some of the Simon and Garfunkel songs. He had the tape on his machine, and he was playing a lot of those songs as we went along on the quiet stretches. So I always remember that. And when we got to hike, somebody from the group met us and took us to the boats out, and we took them back to Lee's Ferry while Martin went on up to the doctor to see about his wounded leg. Actually, I didn't stay for that because I had to go home for one thing. I didn't go on to the rest of the river trips. I went on home.
Okay.
That was a beautiful part of the river, and it's the only time I ever saw anything of canyon lands.
Oh, nice. Nice. Okay. So there were people on that trip, young people, who were encouraging Martin to basically do more river trips. Is that right?
Oh, yes. There were young people who had scurried around transferring cars from the passengers to the end of the trip, helping load the boats, and they really were very helpful in the preparations for the trip. And because the in 1970 the Park Service was going to stop giving out permits. They were going to do a 10-year study of the effects of the water on the river, what was happening to the beaches and all. It was going to be a 10-year study, and they weren't going to add any more concessioners. So they persuaded Martin to apply for the permit, which he got.
Do you, Esther,
yeah?
Do you remember who those young people were?
Oh, yes, yes. It was Connie Flatterville, who helped us a great deal and stayed with us. And there was some of the Tom Turner, I think, and of the Sierra Club. And of course, Dave Brower came along on part of the trips. And I forget now who all, there was some other young men who were working for being part of the Sierra Club in their office. But Connie Flatterville was definitely a marvelous person, but she only stayed on a couple of years. But anyway, they were the ones who said, oh, Martin, all you have to do is sit in the bow. We'll do all the work.
Okay.
So in 1970, Martin was granted the permit, but with not very many user days, which meant that he couldn't take very many people and he couldn't schedule very many trips. He could buy extra user days from some of the other concessioners who had more user days than they needed that they didn't use. So if they had extra user days, Martin could get them to give him these extra user days. But it still wasn't going to be enough to keep a crew busy all summer. And so that was when he started looking around. One of the boatmen, Curtis Chang, I think suggested that in Idaho, the Hell's Canyon area, the snake in Hell's Canyon, that it was possible to get a permit from the Forest Service to run the snake in the Hell's Canyon area. So Martin looked into that, and Curtis Chang and his wife agreed to move to Lewiston to handle possible river business in the Northwest in Idaho, which at that time just consisted of a six-day trip. But I have to tell you about the food, because Marge Children, who lived in Palo Alto and was the wife of Clyde Children, who was the staff photographer at Sunset, she and I would go shopping for the food for the first trips, and our menu was the menu that Pat Riley had used, which was very Spartan.
Wow.
Breakfast was a can of Vienna sausage and a can of grapefruit slices, and for a while he would bring eggs, and there would be scrambled eggs, and for a while there might be bacon. But mostly it was these canned Vienna sausages and the grapefruit.
Yuck.
We copied his menu for lunch. I think it was just I don't remember what. I think it was just crackers and cheese.
Oh.
And then in the evening, the evening was a soup, one of the Lipton's drunk soups, and a can of tamales or a can of macaroni or... Pat Riley, for the first day or so, would bring pieces of chicken or steaks for the first two nights. But after that, it was canned food. And so we would mark the cans with nail polish, because that wouldn't wash off, whereas the paper covers on the cans would disappear, and you wouldn't know what was in the can. So we painted them with the nail polish so we'd know what was in the cans. It was very little regular, I think, with freeze-dried, and it was something that we could freeze. We did pack a few pieces of chicken and some steaks for the first two nights, but after that it was just, but Marty got the idea that there was a nail bread store also had a store for day-old bread.
Okay.
So by that time, he had the plane, and I forget when he bought the plane, but anyway, he would stock up on this day-old bread and fly it to the pudding. I thought that was such expensive day-old bread. It would be older than day-old by the time it got to the river. But anyway, she and I worked out the menus for the first trips, and Martin published a small brochure. We had a mailing list from the Sierra Club, and gradually the mailing list got bigger, and the brochure got bigger. But the thing is, the cost of the trips was, I think it was about $700 for the 20-day trip. And you could go for the first 6 days and hike out, or you could hike down the Bright Angel Trail and join for the last days, the big part of the trip. And the cost of the trips was really unreal. But Martin did that because he wanted families to come. He wanted people to come to see the canyon. He was not a businessman. He really didn't get into it to make any money. What he wanted was to show people what was there in the bottom of the canyon so they would be conscious of the threats to the Grand Canyon. Although they had defeated the two dams, there was always something that was coming up. So we did develop the Northwest trips. We advertised those as an alternative. Many times when people called, and they couldn't go as long a trip as the Grand Canyon was, I would steer them over to the Idaho trips because they were really, in a way, safer for smaller children. And so it was a cheaper trip, and it was 6 days. We expanded from the state park to the Salmon, the lower Salmon. Later, many, many years later, he did the middle Salmon, but primarily it was the lower Salmon and the upper Salmon,
okay,
which were beautiful, beautiful runs. And we scouted the Owyhee and added that to the list, and then we added the Grand Ronde, and so there was quite a bit of choice in the Northwest trips. It's much less rigorous and much, in a way, safer, if you want to say that, for families with small children.
Okay. Let's back up a minute and pick up the airplane. You know, Martin loved to fly. And
yes.
So what kind of plane did he end up buying, and how did that work out?
Well, I was asking Johnny when we bought the plane, and he didn't remember, but Martin's secretary at the time was familiar with the wife of a man, Arnold Sederfitt, who had a 195, and he used the plane to go to Baja, and he had a catalog of airports in Baja, a big catalog of all the airports, most of which were dirt, and he would fly down to Baja quite a bit. Well, when Martin started the river trips, and I don't remember when he bought the plane, but Arnold Sederfitt was very protective of his 195, and he didn't want to sell it necessarily, but Martin persuaded him, and Martin bought his 195, I think, when we started the commercial trips. So, and I don't remember what he paid for it, but he had the plane, which flew from Palo Alto Airport to the Grand Canyon, to Lee's Ferry. Art Green was a trader, and on the approach to Lee's Ferry, Art Green had a motel and a gas station, which is where everybody stayed before the trip started. So I think there was a small strip near there. But anyway, that was where everybody stayed at the beginning of the trip. And as I say, he got the 195, and in later years, he damaged it and got another 195, and that one, I think, was the red and white one. I'm skipping, all over the place at this point because I don't remember the year, but Martin was about to take off from the, I can't remember the name of the town, but it was near Hurricane. It was a commercial strip.
Is that St. George?
Yes, St. George. Yeah, he was gunning the engine to take off when the propeller broke. And it was going so fast, it swung around and pulled the engine off of the fuselage, and the engine crashed into the right wing and smashed the right wing. And Martin was just lucky that he hadn't taken off.
Wow!
Because it turned out in an X-ray of the propeller, it had a crack, which had never been noticed before, which was not visible.
Wow!
Another one.
Oh my gosh.
They were always 195s, which is a tail dragger, a single engine with high wings but no struts. So
okay.
It was excellent for photography.
Yeah, nice.
And it had 13, what is it, spark plugs or something, because he'd have to turn the propeller 13 times.
Oh my gosh. Huh? Oh my. Well, Esther, you know what? We've been talking here happily for an hour. Maybe this is a good place to stop and the next interview.
I'm sorry, I didn't get into the actual workings to create the Redwood National Park because that was quite complicated. But it would be backtracking.
We can do that. Let's talk about Redwood National Park. And then we'll talk about the river in the 1970s. How does that sound?
Yes, that was fine.
Okay. All right.
I'm sorry about the fire drill.
No worries. No problem at all. Okay. And
loud.
Yeah. With that, this will conclude part 5 of a Grand Canyon oral history interview. Today is May 26th, 2020. This interview has been with Esther Litton. And Esther, thank you so very much for a charming interview.
Well, thank you. So this is, after 1989, when Martin sold the company, then the dates get kind of foggy. I'll try to remember things that happened after that.
You know what? We're in 1970, and we have 20 years to go, so no worries.
Technically 1969, the Powell Centennial.
Right. So 20 years, we'll go slow and it'll be fine. We'll cover that ground. Okay.
I hope I live long enough.
Thank you so much. I'll hang on a second.